This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
I hope that everything's slightly easier for them without taking away from the substance of the art.
Welcome back to Songlines, a podcast about First Nations creatives across WA and the path they are paving for the next generation of storytellers. My name is Cesara Kudishnaz, and it's great to be back for a yarn with another excellent West Australian creative. Today, we're chatting with Noongar photographer Cole Baxter. Over the past several years, Cole has made a name for himself in Boorloo, shooting everything from protests to clothing campaigns and community events. His work capturing political demonstrations and local elders has blown up online in recent years for its staunch representation of the First Nations community in WA. Cole comes from a family of strong Indigenous advocates, including his grandfather, Polly Farmer. When he's not behind the lens, he's making his own music or championing Indigenous stories with the Broome-based publishing house Mugabala Books. This is the incredible Cole Baxter for Season 2 of Songlines.
First off, absolutely slayed. Balay, sis. Thanks for having me. I'm fanning out, for real. I've been listening to all the songlines. Danny slides in my emails. Is it slides for emails? Or is that just DMs?
Yeah, I think that counts. Slides you can count. Yeah.
And yeah, go from listening to Fluent and, you know, was it Ani Della that was on as well? And surreal.
This podcast is about First Nations creatives and spans the Noongar seasons. Today we find ourselves in Jilba, which is the beginning of the season of wildflowers, growth and renewal. What does this time of year mean for you?
That is a great question. I love the words that you used to describe it. Growth, renewal. I don't know. I think it's nice to pause and think about that kind of stuff because I could use a lot more of that in my life. I'm kind of a bit too, like, always thing going.
Going.
I guess it makes me, in a real literal sense, like, think of Kings Park and, like, the wildflowers.
Mm.
Such a beautiful spot there. I absolutely love it. Like, go there for runs. I've been going there my whole life before I ran and, you know, I've done shoots galore and I used to live down the road from there and just go out there at nighttime when the lights were off and they turn the sprinklers on and maybe just, like, look over at the skyline. So that's really where my mind's going. And I think as well because of what's happening at the moment with them bugs that have made their way over and at Kings Park and Hyde Park. Yeah. It's Winyan, like, this morning I was seeing, I think they were, getting, like, cut down really right on Mounts Bay Road there. You know, they're cutting down, like, 20% of them or something like that. They were just, like, biggest mob of cars and trucks and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, that's sad. But that's just an element of it. I think, really, the words that you were using to describe the season are, real positive ones and ones that cause to pause for reflection, which I think is... We all need to slow down. I need to slow down. I've gotten, like, obsessed. I'm like that, like, perpetual motion thing in, like, The Simpsons. It's just always moving. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
It's also that, like, the joy of working in the arts is it feels like you can't slow down. Otherwise, suddenly you'll have no work ever if you decide to take, like, 2 weeks off.
How lame is it, though? I kind of, like, did this too when I, like, came in and sat down. The classic thing of, like, what you been up to? Oh, I'm so busy. It's like, oh, what are you up to? Oh, I'm so busy.
I'm so tired.
That's all you like. That's all we can do. We can only be tired and busy.
Yeah. It's all we are in the arts is tired and busy. Because I think we both did that. We're like, oh, how are you going? Oh, I'm tired and busy. Mm. But it's great.
Mm.
The joys. So... Like, actually, that's a very good segue to talk about your work in the arts. So as a photographer, you often look at the world through a lens and use visual mediums to communicate things rather than words. Do you find it easier to portray what you're wanting to through photos rather than trying to attribute words to moments?
I think I'm at this great stage now where I have the benefit of people being really familiar with me. Mm. So they kind of know what I stand for and what I'm all about.
Mm.
So when they see an image of mine that's really iconic of the work that I'm doing and the spaces that I occupy, it's the writing's on the wall for, like, what my point of view is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Now that I, like, unpack that, maybe that's going to be a hindrance in the long run because I'm, like, pigeonholing myself. I don't know. I love to, yeah, the double meaning of what you're saying with the lens thing. I love to be like a documentarian, like a fly on the wall, yeah. Do candid reportage style photography. But even within that, it's not just like, you know, taking a photo when folks don't know you're there. I'm still able to.
You're part of it.
Yeah, I'm still able to inject. Yeah, these are spaces that I am a part of, and I am able to inject my point of view and angle on these sort of scenarios when they are in those settings. And then I guess when it is in. So I guess I'm referring to, yeah, rallies, protests, live events, you know, social issues. Those are the spaces that I'm predominantly occupying that people really know me for. But then as well, I'm sort of now moving a little bit more into the fine art space where it's still got these themes of resilience and staunchness and protest and, you know, Noongar-ness, just being a black fella, that kind of thing. And it's doing it through a different vessel of like intentionality and directing a scene and trying to have those topics and themes hopefully bubble to the surface. So when the viewer's looking at them, I guess they don't have that. They have the preconceived notion of, oh, this is all the stuff that Cole's about, but it's not framed with the natural setting of a protest or a rally. Hopefully those themes and underlying things can still shine through, which I think they can. And it's more challenging there. I like it.
I think it's that idea of how there's more than one way to show an idea. There's kind of, you got polarizing versions of showing a moment within, like in the documentary style of photography that you do, where you're in the moment, and then there's trying to recreate. So how do we recreate those themes of staunchness and of the incredible resilience that our people have and the joy that we have despite everything? How do we then take that idea and put it into an art that we create fully rather than like a different type of creation, I suppose? Wow, we could actually just sit here and talk about how we both create art for hours, I think, and that would be a whole other podcast.
I'll say something that's testament to that, the thing that you said about photography being a visual medium. This is like radio podcast right now. I'm nodding along. The mics don't pick up nodding. There's no video camera for that. So there's a real strong, loud nod happening here in agreement.
Just for the audience, if there's ever silence from Cole's behalf, just know he's most likely nodding.
Agreeing with everything.
Just picture it. So photography is already kind of like one specific way of seeing the world. And then we add on the layer of also being Indigenous. It's a very broad question, but how has being Indigenous and that part of you affected the way you've gone about your photography and the way that the role that you see photography playing?
I think it's just allowed meaningfulness to blossom in basically everything that I do. So I'm in these spaces that I would be in if I wasn't for photographing things, but the way that I feel that I can meaningfully contribute to raising the positive visibility of black fellas and showing the younger generations what we're capable of, how we can be as deadly as possible, allows me to do the things that I love, meaningfully inhabit these spaces, and just do things, I guess, proper ways, because I don't want to be inserting myself onto any of these scenes or spaces. I want people to hopefully be like, yeah, he's doing it right. And if not, then I want to listen to that. And, you know, I guess, like, I was having this discussion with a friend yesterday. It's almost like, I think it's almost like a fair skin tax as well. Like, if I'm going to be like a public black fella, I feel like to take up that space, I need to be like providing something meaningful for other folks to use, and to also just like really let it be known, no, I want to do things proper ways. I don't want to like take anything for granted because I'm able to inhabit Earth as someone who is not going to get like publicly profiled and have to deal with like all of the BS that our mob put up with. So for me, using that as like a stencil, as a template, as like a guideline, just helps me inhabit these spaces, do things proper ways, and then people love it. And when you are in that reciprocal symbiotic relationship with your own community, you can simultaneously help others and fill up your own cup at the same time. Yeah. It's almost like I'm being selfish by doing the work that I do because it makes me feel so good. And I think and I hope and I try to make it so it's intrinsically tied to being supportive of others, like I said, raising that positive visibility of black fellas, you know, Noongar specifically on Noongar country, but black fellas in general that just live here and, you know, across the continent on the many countries that are here.
Yeah, it's that idea of how the work serving not only a purpose for yourself, but a purpose for kind of the wider community and kind of by doing both. Sometimes it's through our art that we can connect with our culture and with our community, and it feels both, as you said, so like filling your own cup, but then also, oh, I'm doing something with this thing I really, really love. I'm able to do something positive with it and make change in the way that comes most naturally.
I'll give another example as well that's less abstract, because I kind of went around the whole block to knock on the next door neighbour just then. I am working in these spaces with so many deadly folks in many realms of the arts and non-arts, just other Noongars that are doing really powerful, amazing stuff. And because of my work, it kind of opens up that door and I get to connect with them. And it opens up doors that are outside of the arts as well. Like, for example, my brother boy, Dylan Collard, absolute sweetheart. He does language classes.
Yes.
And because of the work that I've done, it's allowed me to link up with these mob and it's non-photographic, but it's because of that, through what is meaningful to me to capture, which are Noongars, practicing culture, non-cultural elements as well, just us flourishing, winning, being out there, just existing. So I get to, practice our language, learn Noongar. You know, that's something that I wasn't brought up with.
Yeah.
My mum wasn't brought up with. My pop wasn't brought up with. So, you know, it's a space that can become like emotional quite quick. You know, you think about it and it's like, fuck, we're just existing now doing this thing, which is like learning a language. And it is, there's so many, that in itself is just like staunch and it's powerful. And it just like, fills me up, makes me feel complete. And I think that's a symptom of, like, I don't need to be a photographer to do that, but it's because of that it's like made all these things so much more
it's
easy.
It's connected
to do.
Everything together.
Yeah. And then it flows back into the photography, because then I'm like, this fella, Dylan, is killing it. I want to champion his story. I'm going to like take photos of him. You know, we did a photo shoot, taking photos of him doing welcomes at music festivals as well. Just one recently. But yeah, it's so, everything is intertwined. Mm. Everything supports one another. You kind of can't isolate things. You've got to be up for it all. And when you are, everything just feels great.
It's interesting because it's a common sentiment actually I've heard from a lot of Indigenous artists of not separating not separating things and how it all kind of intertwines together, because there's a heavy within like Western arts culture, there's a kind of heavy emphasis on separating all the different things you do within your life. But pretty much every single Indigenous artist I've talked to is like, I don't separate any of those things, whether the art's related or not, they all kind of feed into one another. And it's just like an interesting, it's very interesting.
I could keep yarning about this, or would that be me going on too long?
Yeah, keep going. It's our podcast.
So without even thinking about it, basically all of the work that I'm doing is with other Noongars and black fellas that live here. I'm going to do meaningful work no matter what. All of that's meaningful. Sometimes I'll do meaningful work as well that isn't necessarily with black fellas, but that's the minority. And to give you an anecdote, I did some work recently that I was kind of like, why am I doing this? The pay is good. But like, people that I so love, adore and respect pay me well also to do the work. And it wasn't until after something bad happened that I was like, ah, okay, that was a red flag. I don't need to just be doing stuff for the money, because there's always these secret costs. And yeah, it was working with someone who was not a black fella, which in itself, that is completely meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. That wasn't the red flag. The red flag was, what am I doing here? Then when something bad happened, I was like, ah, that's right. There's no overlap between us. You do not understand or see the world the way that I see the world. There's no shared or common ground. Mm. So there was some nice food for thought in that don't need to say yes to everything. There's lots of, I'm really privileged, I'm really lucky, there's lots of meaningful work out there. And yeah, I think that's just testament to the spaces that I covet and the power that is sort of within them.
That's very cool. You're quite eloquent, you know that?
Thank you.
You're quite good at words.
I think I like to overcompensate maybe when I feel like I'm using, you know, just one syllable words. I'll like, oh, better add a couple of extra big ones in there.
No, I do feel that as well. Unfortunately, I'm the type of person, if you start talking to me about my work, I won't stop unless someone tells me, can we move subjects? I'm like, no.
But you got to be able to describe what you do. And being in like the theatre, arts, acting space, like you got
to... We need to be really good at words.
Particularly with like directing scenes, you kind of got to like find that little tiny nuance to be like, you're like, almost there. I just want you to find that extra emotion.
Finding the right word to use? Good Lord. Good Lord. Takes like so many times that I've been directing, it's taken me like a couple of goes of the scene to be like, oh, wait, okay, I now know how to tell you what I've been trying to tell you for the past 20 minutes. Let's just move on.
Do you see yourself like if someone's going to be like, hey, what do you do? Or like, give me the cliff notes, the business card. Do you start off with I'm a director, or I'm an actor, or do you say I'm in the acting space?
I'm really boring. I just say I work in the arts. I tried the term theatre maker for a while, but personally, I don't like that term. I don't know why. It itches my brain in the wrong way. No shade to anyone who uses the term theatre maker, by the way, for anyone listening. I just don't use the word myself. So I tend to just say I work in the arts, and then I get, oh, what do you do in the arts? And I'm like, I act, direct, and write. And then that's like, I don't have a succinct way of saying what I do other than working in the arts. If I'm working on something, I would tend to lead with what I'm working on at the time. So if I'm directing a show, I'll say, oh, I'm a director, but I also do this, this, and this. If I'm acting in a show, it'll go that way around.
Yeah.
The joys of working in the arts and doing 50 bajillion things. We love life.
Oh, you're killing it.
Oh, keep so it up. Are you. Also, it's really funny. Half of these podcasts sometimes, especially with the people that I know and have a like pre-existing relationship with, accidentally turn into being about me for about 10 minutes. And I'm like, wait, no, guys, guys. But it is very lovely. Like, I mean, it's great. Back to you. We do start kind of a lot of our podcasts with talking about the beginnings of how kind of everything fell into place. So you've been shooting professionally for a few years now, but photography has been a part of your identity for a long time before that. When did photography first enter your life?
I think like growing up, like photography was around. Like I can remember Dad always having a Polaroid camera. So, and that's such a physical, instantaneous medium. Those memories are indelibly etched on my young self to now. And then as I got older and start to have my own cameras, like in high school, having the sort of compact digital cameras of the 2000s, you're just, there's no artistic or composition sort of element to it. It's just like...
Take and go.
Yeah, exactly. But then maybe there was almost even a lapse, like all that. So yeah, in my teens, early 20s, just taking photos, just, you know, nothing artistic, nothing really documenting other than just the malaise of my life. And at that age, I was more concerned with trying to become a model. Like that was something I was really trying to be like, this is an industry. Well, that was many years ago. So if you can see something, then that's cool. So that was on my mind. I was like, no, I got to do this. I need to do this and that and this and that, and put a lot of effort into it with not a heck of a lot of outcome. And it just became too sort of difficult, but I really liked the space. There was something about like being, you know, in a photo shoot or being in spaces with cameras taking photos, you know, runways, other commercial things, editorial stuff, that I was like, okay, maybe this is like a lane that I can kind of go into. And it was such like a slow burn. Like that was an idea that was in my mind, but I didn't like buy a camera and start working on sets immediately or start doing commercial work immediately. The person I was seeing at the time had a DSLR camera and I got to learn how to use that, but it was still kind of just taking nondescript stuff. Then I got my first DSLR in 2015. And again, still just taking photos just of like mates, kind of not doing a heck of a lot, but the images started to look better because the equipment was better. And, you know, slowly turning that dial. And then I think what was really beneficial was like working in our spaces a bit more, like working at an ACO, the things that I was like taking photos of like lots of, you know, various mob and other Noongars like around me was becoming like more interesting and more meaningful, and like filling up that internal thing in me of like meaningfully contributing, like I said earlier, to the community that's around me. So that just like really made me just feel strong and more interested. And then I was working at the Centre for Aboriginal Studies at Curtin University. So I'm surrounded by all of this Black excellence, all of these academics that, you know, are maybe like the first, you know, older folks that are maybe like the first or the second generation to like get a bachelor's degree, get a master's, get a PhD, all of this just like amazing stuff, stories that it's like, whoa, like this is, these stories need to be captured. And then all these young mob as well. I was just an academic student engagement officer. So I'm yarning with all of these teens and early 20s folks, as well as mature age students that are stepping into this study period of their life, trying to, you know, improve their circumstances. And it's just, it really is just so nourishing of storytelling and resilience and Blackness. And it just made every photo that I took that much more special and meaningful to me, as well as I think an offering to folks that were around me. So very naturally from there, the opportunity started to rise, you know, taking more photos at things like rallies, a really pivotal moment that is like so strange to think how it really positively affected my photography career, was the like, you know, awful George Floyd incident in the States. Like that made it so people over here were like, oh, that's so awful. Wait a minute. Hold on. Maybe there's some awful stuff happening here. Oh, okay. And then, you know, with the closing of the world and the BLM movement happening and that mirror that people were holding up to themselves to see, oh, we've got racism in our own backyard, just meant we want to see this now. Our eyes are open to this. So when I was taking photos at rallies, protests, taking photos of us even just existing,
became
protest to the mainstream, because people were not used to seeing that. Now they're really wanting to see it. So in itself, there's this theme of protest, because it's like these spaces that are historically not occupied by us are now open for us to do the things that are synonymous with protest and do just us existing and killing it, because that is protest in these mainstream spaces. And it just made it that I was spoilt for opportunity. There was just so many things for me to take photos of, get paid for, have it be meaningful, edify the next shoot that I do, inform the community of who I am. And yeah, I just haven't looked back since.
It's interesting, because you actually also kind of answered the next question I was going to ask you, which was about the Black Lives Matter movement and how that, as you said, it kind of kicked everything off. And it is such a weird, it was such a specific moment in time as well that won't ever, like, I don't think can ever be recreated. Because I remember really clearly that when it happened, when the Black Lives Matter movement kicked off in America and then it kicked off over here, there was, I remember there was so much confusion almost from a kind of the wider community as to how it translated over here and what the connection between the two were. Because I think that actually might have been when I started following you, was during that moment. Because I think someone shared one of your photos. Like, if I'm correct, that was also when I started to see your photography as well. What was that like, kind of blowing up at a time and going almost viral at a time where you were documenting something that, I mean, I don't know about you during the time, but it was such an overwhelming time. And what, there's this juxtaposition between it being like all the horrible things that have been happening to us being all over the internet, while at the same time your contribution to it kind of blowing up, and the juxtaposition of the two things happening at the same time. What was that like?
Yeah, juxtaposition is a great word. And I think I was
that word.
I think I was really able to have it be mostly supportive of me, because of this awful thing, it boosted the social literacy and desire to be aware of these awful things, so that people wanted to open their eyes and they wanted to see that sort of stuff. And in like a really kind of numpty way, people were like, oh, this stuff is awful. Our eyes are open. We want to see it. Oh, they're kind of like throwing all the things into the bag. Like, oh, you know, mistreatment from the police. Let's chuck that in there. Oh, just, yeah, like we've discussed, blackfellas being blackfellas. Let's chuck that in there as well. They're the same thing. We want to see it all.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, they're not the same thing, but I am going to take photos of community events, cultural events, positive stuff, us just being, having a great time, inhabiting spaces, and the folks that got here through kind of a crappy means are going to look at that, want to see it, support it. So I was really lucky in that sense. And because it was happening in this disconnected time where we're having all of the lockdowns, you know, shooting was less abundant, but then the desire to see the photos that I was taking was boosted up. So that is that juxtaposition. And then once it completely meant, once it was opened back up, that we were able to more freely move amongst public with one another, there was just so many things happening. I guess as well, it was that sort of stoppage for a while, kind of like, you know, a stream in a bilia, like a river, and like a dam stoppage, and then it opens up. It's like all this pressure and all this force had been pushing on it, and now it's like the floodgates are open.
And it had pushed so much because we were all in lockdown at the time while it was happening. It was, other than obviously the lockdown, it was the main thing everybody was talking about because no one was doing anything else. Mm. And there was almost nothing. There was nothing to distract from what was happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah, well put. Very insightful.
Yeah. So as you said, there was this, the pressure on the dam, and when it opened, it was just insane.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know what I'll say as well? Like, I don't even, like, you and I, lots of other folks in the art space, maybe just blackfellas in general or public, you know, public folks that are blackfellas or in that space. Mm. I don't think that my circumstantial experience, the anecdote of me as a professional person and, you know, becoming somewhat of a public person is emblematic of everyone else's. I haven't really encountered much resistance, or at least not a lot where it's like really gotten me down. The stuff that gets me down is when I see fucking Poxy C's up in, you know, Broome tying up our kids.
Yeah.
People, maybe it's because of that as well. If I ever do get attacked, or if there ever is like a tiny disparaging thing against me, it's just fucking meaningless.
No, I know what you mean, because it's interesting, because I think we have that similar experience of sitting in a space where we are so aware of the things that we don't cop sometimes in the day-to-day life, and how it, with that, I think as you said earlier, with that comes, it feels like a responsibility to shed light on what happens on, you said it earlier, and it's like with that kind of comes, it feels like it comes this responsibility to, I don't know if it's a capacity thing because we don't cop it in the day-to-day life, but it's, oh, I can't find the word for it, but it's like exactly what you were saying in terms of, it's not the day-to-day stuff that kills it. It's everything we see happening to everybody around us, and this spot of like, okay, so what can I possibly do to make this situation that I haven't been a part of, but so many people I love have been a part of, how can I use my own privilege to make that better? Somehow. God, this is so much fun. I'm having the time of my life.
I want to shout out Danny on the decks. We've done a shoot together as well, and Danny is absolutely slaying now.
We love Danny. Danny is why this podcast is happening. If it was up to me running this, there wouldn't be a podcast. I don't have that level of organisation.
It's not a visual medium, but Danny just did a backflip into the worm.
Yeah.
Serious breakdancing in the studio.
You've heard it here. Songlines. Danny did a backflip. So... Rerouting, both of us. So rerouting back. What? Okay. So a lot of the photography work you do, as we've spoken about, is within the activism space and within was about to say podcast for some reason, which is absolutely not the word, but rallies and protests. What is it like being at the heart of those movements and taking those photos? Like, is it different being part of it and taking photos compared to just, not to just, but compared to not documenting it? Like, how does documenting it while it's happening change your experience of the moment?
It gives me such meaning and intentionality.
Mm.
And maybe it's being like a fidgeter, just holding something in your hand. So it's a tool. I'm meant to be here and use it. It gives me clarity and I think a healthy amount of disconnect because when I'm in these spaces and people are chanting, sometimes I will, but a lot of the time I'm like, no, I'm looking at that bench because I'm going to run over there and stand on it. And there's six cool signs that I just saw that I want to like get really close in with this telescopic lens that's 40 meters away, but is up close in their face and go chuk-chuk-chuk. And a lot of the time, my wife won't want to come to the rally because I'll just run away from her. And she'll be like, well, I want to walk together. And I'm like, yeah, but I need to like.
Yeah, go. But I've got a vision.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it helps. And I think it helps me do it consistently. Like, for example, with the Poxy referendum last year, the National Library asked me to take photos and were going to pay me a lot of money. And I was like, I really don't want to be in this space on that day. But you know what? This is like, it's back to what I was saying earlier. It was a big red flag standing right in front of me. I should have seen it already. And the first polling place that I went to, someone said something to me that was like a tiny kind of crappy thing to say. It was not even that big. And I was just so already to be sent. And it totally sent me. And I got into an altercation with someone. And then some people had to like get in there. And I like left and called mum and started crying. Was just like, what am I doing? There's no point in being here on this day. The emotional labor is just not worth it.
The emotional labor is out of control.
So, you know, having the camera didn't help that day. But
I think that day as well was so specific because, like, there was this event happening. It wasn't a response to an event. It was the event happening, which takes away that, I think, it makes it harder to have the separation because you're not at an event responding to an event. You're at the event that will be responded to, if that makes any sense.
Makes tremendous sense. And what I just realized as well is when I'm at these Invasion Day protests, BLM protest, deaths in custody protests, you know, specific ones to folks that have been, you know, have died by the mistreatment of police, a lot of the time, we are all there. I'm seeing all these familiar faces.
You're all together.
It's power. I'm boosted by the togetherness. So it just...
Rather than being on your own.
Yeah, exactly. Makes you a bit stronger.
Yeah, and I think there's something in... like it, when you're talking about how the using the camera kind of offers a level of separation that makes it easier, it's once again that idea of how so many of us within the community use the arts as a way to kind of process... not only as a way to like educate, but also just a way to process what's going on. And it's almost like through the camera, it's like a way of processing the event. And yes, it's just an interesting thing about how so many of us who are in the space use the arts to do that and to find the words that maybe within the moment in our day-to-day lives are much, much harder to find.
Yeah.
I have a fun question now.
Hey, this whole thing's been
this
fun.
Danny
was breakdancing.
So good.
We're reminiscing.
what? Do you have any photo shoot highlights? Do you have any like fave photo shoots you've been on that you're like, that just goes down in memory forever?
A big one was with Clothing the Gaps in the start of 2021 in about March.
Oh, cool.
I'd just a few months earlier left my job at the Centre for Aboriginal Studies because I was like, I just can't do this and be a photographer full time. And the reason I flagged that is because the shoot was back at CAS, the Centre for Aboriginal Studies. I was always posting funny videos of me and an uncle I work with at the centre just wearing our Clothing the Gaps shirts and just doing hilarious stuff. And then after a while, they were like, oh, this guy is a photographer.
This guy's cool.
And They were like, yeah, let's do a shoot. We'll do a big shoot on Noongar country.
What a brilliant way of getting work.
Oh, totally. We're going to have all black fellas. You know, we put an open call out. This was happening at that time as well. I remember at Yuriyarkin there putting up a little video like, hey, just, you know, we got this shoot coming up. You know, if you want to be a part of it, chime in.
I remember that. And I think I wanted to be a part of it, but I think I was working that day.
Yeah, well, oh, it was... It was amazing.
I remember seeing the call out for that. It was incredible.
Mm. We had so many people respond. I remember doing a Zoom with one of the folks at Clothing the Gap, Sienna, and we had like 100 tabs of all these socials Jesus. Profiles of people that were like, oh, we want to be a part of it. And we were like, okay, we want everyone, but even...
How do you pick?
Yeah, it was tricky. It was kind of like, I think what we led with was... Well, let's like look what these people are all about. Like, yeah. Oh, cool. Like they're posting stuff for being in their spaces. No brainers. Those are all black fellas anyway. But it was hard to pick. I remember as well. I can even like think of some of the folks that we didn't have a part of it. And I felt bad and then have since like made connections with them. And then I'm like, oh, messed that up. But that was such a massive shoot. We had 37 people modeling. Holy all black shit. Fellas, everyone set black fellas at the Center for Aboriginal Studies. It was a long 13-hour day shoot. It was massive.
Brutal.
Made so many connections that day with people that I've done individual shoots with since then. See out and about, you know, we do Who's Your Mob, Where You're From to begin with.
Mm.
And I remember saying that. I was like, there's like 50 of us people here. I know it's going to take a long ass time, but we just got to do it. 50 minutes later, everyone knows who one another is. The day can start. And then, yeah, 12 more hours go on. That was amazing and was such a door opener for that relationship with Clothing the Gaps, all the mob that came through. That's like probably a big early on one that really sticks out as being like important and fun and really something that I was like grateful that could happen. I spoke about that for a while, but yeah, there's more.
I have a question. Do you have, so a lot of performers have like, I know I do, but like have like pre-performance rituals that we do like before every single performance or whatever. Do you have like pre-photo shoot or event rituals that you go through?
I think for me, not so much just ones where it's just me, but if I am on a shoot and it's in a small space, if we've got time, if I'm directing as well as shooting, which is often the case, I just like to really establish that this is a setting where creating something awesome and really of substance and then feeling comfortable are not mutually exclusive from one another. Because I think there's this real old guard mentality that is still pervasive in the arts and on photo shoot settings that, no, you got to be quick. This is a commercial thing. You got to, no, you're not meant to feel comfortable. If you're professional, you're going to get it done nice and quick.
Yeah.
And I think for me, a lot of the time, I'm not necessarily working with professional actors or models, even if it is for a commercial thing, because I like to, if I am able to be in charge of it, like with the Clothing the Gaps thing, engage folks that are just like regular people that are beautiful and have a story and just let them know, hey, we're here to be comfortable. If you don't feel comfortable, that's okay. Step out.
How do we make this work?
Yeah. How do we make this work? So that, you know, that can look like, yeah, who's your mob, where you're from, getting everyone to know what's up, explaining a bit about myself and what's important to me. And that always becomes ahead of the outcomes, because if you get too bogged down on the outcomes, then, yeah, just nastiness can exist.
Also, the outcomes tend to get better when everybody's comfortable and having a good time. Like, you can tell. You can 1,000%. Tell on stage. You can tell through the camera. Like, it's just... Make time for it, guys. God.
Mm. So, yeah, I so agree with that. And that's what's present in my mind when you see people relax, when you see people, oh, I don't like to have my photo taken. Okay, well, that's all good. I'll distract you. And then, oh, just made you laugh for a second. Oh, I gotcha.
Candids are the way to go with people who aren't comfortable in it. You just make them laugh. Someone talk at them and it will work.
Yeah.
So your work within the photography space and also just within all the spaces, has led to you being a part of Ngalak Wangkin, a multimedia project to preserve the legacy of our state's elders through photography and other visual mediums. What's that project been like? What's it been like to be a part of that?
That was pretty crazy because that was still happening during the lockdowns and wearing masks, and we're working with elders who the project was to showcase their stories, and they really saw this as an opportunity for their legacies to live on when they were gone. And, you know, these are some old folks. Three of the elders passed away during the project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, we went into I probably can't say names, but, yeah, we, you know, it looked like for one of the shoots going into someone's house, and with the project, as you put it, multimedia, there was a podcast series and a short film as well as a book that came out that I was the principal photographer for. So there was a podcast being shot in this house, and we were with one deadly auntie who was so at peace with, you know, passing away really soon. She knew that it was imminent, and being in that space, taking these amazing photos of her with her family and the tears and her telling her story, and, you know, we're sort of like tearing up as well, and then, you know, finding, and, you know, we're wearing masks, so there's this kind of balance of back and forth, like, oh, too close, not too close enough, and then finding out, you know, that she passed away a few days later, it sort of was like, wow, this is really powerful, impactful. You know, it felt kind of crass, but it was like, oh, that's amazing that we got these images and were welcomed into that space for her and her family as well. But trying to, you know, have that be the silver lining as a little W in like a respectful way was difficult, but it was amazing. It was, and they're so eclectic, the elders that were a part of that. You know, one of the shoots was with Uncle Ben Taylor, who I absolutely adore, and he goes to all of the protests and rallies. He's about 84 now. he kind of shares a bit of a resemblance, particularly when he was a bit younger, to my granddad, and I absolutely love my granddad. So I think there's that there as well. When I look at this old fella's face, you know, it just kind of warms my heart. And eventually, as it often is the case with these old folks, hung out with them enough where he remembered my name, saw me coming from a distance. He's going, oh, there's Polly's grandson. And I think it maybe took him writing down in his little notebook that he wears in his shirt pocket three times, like Cole and my phone
number.
That's so good. It is so gorgeous. And we did a shoot. It was kind of strange. We did a shoot at Fremantle Prison where he had been a prisoner in like
Holy shit. 60s.
Yeah. Hadn't been back there since then. Why would you? You know, at the time you needed a white fella license basically to buy alcohol. He had one, did that, but he shared a bottle of wine with a family member. So he went to prison for like 3 to 6 months.
Oh, great. Love life.
Jesus Christ. Woo-hoo. And, you know.
Sarcasm, by the way.
Definitely.
If no one can hear if listeners cannot hear my tone, it's sarcasm, I promise.
Massively picked up. And, yeah, he hadn't been in this space in over, like, almost half a century. Everything was crystal clear. Like, there was a plaque on the wall with all of the superintendents or, you know, the big Britiers in there, the bosses, and it said, you know, something like 1954 to 1960 something, E.G. Kant was this bloke's name. And Uncle Ben saw that straight away. I was like, they spelt his last name wrong. Don't this bloke's burning in hell. It was so funny. I was like, oh my God, Uncle, that is massive. Like, slay, pop off. And it was so interesting. It was very eerie. Walking around in there and hearing his yarns, and we took a very powerful photo in there where the gallows was, and it's really striking. It's Uncle Ben in the foreground looking sort of just like,
oh, wow,
you know, having all of this space kind of come back and like wash over him in like very mixed sort of way, and then in the background it's very dark and you can see the gallows, and obviously it's sort of symbolic of that thing always looming in his life but in the past. And that was maybe my favorite photo from the book, and the book kind of like, maybe that was my next big pivotal moment, like the Clothing the Gaps shoot. I'm sure that helped with it, but that, you know, there was a physical book with an ISBN barcode on the back that was published, and people, yeah, were able to see my work on a large scale like that and know that I've kind of worked with these elders. And for the most part, you know, I think the ones that we're lucky to still have here, when I see them, it's, you know, biggest love. And And, you know, I felt like I really had to kind of earn that because they've lived these massive, amazing lives. And that was special. Yeah, love that book. Love that project. It's still paying dividends.
I also have to say, I don't think some elders realize how cool they are. Because when I gush to elders sometimes, which is pretty much every single time I meet an elder and then I just start gushing at them, they always say, I get a bit of confusion sometimes. I'm like, but no, you're just so cool. It's like, I want to be you and I grow up. Come on.
No, that's great. Some of them do know, though.
Some of them do know.
But yeah, no, you're right. That's great. So good.
So to deviate from photography kind of for this end bit, some people don't know that you've been a musician for longer than you've been a photographer. How do those two mediums kind of ever cross over together? Like, what's that like kind of working in these two art spaces, but that are, there is a kind of distinct difference between the two?
No, they don't cross over at all.
No?
I think maybe
two
through...
Two completely different calls?
Yeah. You know what? I started making music and performing music and releasing music when I would have been about 18.
Yeah.
So I'm 33 now, so it's quite a while ago. And that in itself was like a completely different life. And I sort of did that and it scratched the itch and I loved it and it was amazing. And then I let it be for a long time and then it kind of came back into my life. And this was now medium age Cole in his mid-20s, who is like single for the first time in his life, had been in a long-term relationship previously, and is obsessed with R&B music. So every single song is about some girl that didn't like me as much as I liked her. And I think I've like now finally transitioned from that, having been in a monogamous relationship for 8 years now, being married for a year. I can't continue to sing about that sort of stuff, but I love it. I can listen to it and absolutely love it. And yeah, it just doesn't, I think almost forcefully, I make it not interact with the photographic side of who I am, because there's no cultural elements. There's no elements where I'm like, you know, bolstering other mob. Like I am now that I'm like learning more language. I would like to ingratiate that into some of my songs. And like I said, I've kind of tried to put the, I think just naturally through time, those chapters of like, you know, kind of R&B music are now more behind me and I can, you know, there's probably other things to like write music about out there. Although when I do the random gig here and there, my wife is a bit like, we don't need to keep hearing this song that was written like 8 years ago about like some random chick who was in your life for like a couple of weeks or some like, imaginary hypothetical relationship that like never occurred. And I'm like, babe, you are so right.
That's a really interesting thing about writing is that, like, because I even clock it when I read through like plays I've written. You can clock exactly what I was obsessed with at the exact moment that I wrote that play. Like, there's such, and you don't think about it when you're writing it. When you're writing, you don't think about how much that's actually like a time capsule for that moment of your life.
When I am writing stuff, in the past when I had, and it was like very influenced from like R&B music, which like the tropes are just like so set in stone, it's difficult to fray out of like, you know, baby stuff, that I might take like a molecule of an experience that I had, or more so an emotion that I had, and then make it a completely fictitious song. So although, yeah, maybe it started with something that I had with someone, it's not really about them at all.
No, I do remember as well, I wrote a show about a set of triplets that no longer spoke. And I had so many people ask me if me and my brothers no longer talked to each other. So I had to give a disclaimer before the reading of being like, this is not about me and my brothers. Our relationship is fine. We're okay. But it's interesting how I think people can assume that it's about your life more than sometimes it is.
Interesting.
And that parasocial relationship that kind of comes about within the arts.
Hey, one thing I will say that maybe will nice and tightly tied in a bow with the music stuff. I think maybe I'm a little bit more mature now where musically I can see it being ingratiated into my life, which photographically is really massive. And not that I want to write songs about taking photos or anything like that. But what I get in terms of being a part of a community as a Noongar person and a photographer, I think I can see getting musically as well, because over the past couple of years, it just initially naturally happened. There was a music festival and I was like, oh, someone's playing there and I'd like to go there and hang out. Maybe I'll just message them. And they were artists and they were like, yeah, come along, take photos. Had a great, amazing time. Just turned out that I just did that for every single festival the past 2 years. Whatever black fellas are playing, I'm hitting them up. And for
that's so cool.
Like,
oh, that's so good.
And when it's like I've just made some great friendships from that as well. Like my brother boy, Tasman Keith, he did Laneway last year. Mm. Absolute sweetheart. We had a deadly time. And now whenever I see him killing it, I'm just like even more so, like, absolutely love you, bros. And being in those spaces as a photographer, seeing Mob blossom, it is great. I get to be a part of that and support it and just enjoy it and then be a fan as well as like, you know, be backstage free, all that kind of stuff and hanging out with everyone. It's pretty cool.
The real reason why people do photography.
Oh, absolutely. But now it's kind of got me being like, well, what, can I be in this space as an artist? So I'm kind of going mentally into a new chapter there. And
that's cool.
It's cool, yeah.
Watch this space, people.
Yeah.
Woohoo.
Yeah.
That is fun. For R&B music, that is not just baby, baby, baby.
Surely there have been some hits about other things. I mean, what comes to mind first?
It's like Neo. It's Neo and all his songs about girls that didn't like him.
Mm.
Like, I specifically remember So Sick. And I think I started playing it and my brother was like, it's not the mood for that song. The wrap-up question that I've asked, I think, everybody who's come onto the podcast is, what are your hopes for the next generation of storytellers?
Oh, that's great. I hope that everything's slightly easier for them without taking away from the substance of the art.
Yeah.
And I don't want to fetishize the tortured artist, because I don't think you need to be miserable to create something amazing. But obviously a lot of really iconic and amazing stories have come out of that. So, you know, for me, my life, for the most part, in terms of accessibility and options, is pretty incredible. Like, I just try to show as much love to the access that I've had as possible. And then I think before me, think about my mum, think about my pop, you know, what was it like for them? Think about my pop especially, who, you know, grew up in a time where, you know, people were being taken away from their families and, you know, he grew up in an institution and, you know, I run. And he, when he was like 5 or 6, just found a shoe in the bush and wore one shoe.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of mythology around him, like having one leg longer than the other because of that. But sometimes when I'm like doing an event and I'm running and I'm feeling like tired and sore and I'm wearing these like several $100 shoes, at the end I'm like talking to myself, I'm like, really? You're going to, like, give up now? Like,
yeah.
Bud only had one shoe and you're giving up now these expensive shoes. That's me, like, you know, pushing myself. And I guess what I'm saying is shit was pretty hard for him, pretty damn hard. He did some amazing stuff, slightly easier for mum, slightly easier for me. Hopefully it's
continues to get slightly easier.
Yeah, it just gets – if each generation it becomes slightly easier for them, then – that's what I hope I can be a part of as well, with taking photos of Mob just absolutely killing it. So there is this positive visibility of us for us and the mainstream as well. So then our younger Mob aren't getting, you know, the ridiculousness that, you know, comes our way sometimes from uninformed people. Hopefully the uninformed people are slightly less uninformed in the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been so much fun. Probably going to be reflected in how long this episode is. but thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Oh, this has been great. I've been smiling the whole time and have had such an absolute pleasure of a time being here and have been really looking forward to it and respect you so much and what you've done with the pod. So this is just crazy that I get to be on here as well. It's surreal.
It's because you're just that cool.
Oh, okay.
You're
watch
just
out.
Just that cool. Yeah.
I don't know about that.
Thanks for joining me on this month's episode of Songlines. Our guest today was Cole Baxter. This episode of Songlines was produced and edited by Danielle Raphael. Our music is by Matakich with artwork by Wayne Ryder. Big thanks to Kobe Arthur Morrison for his consultation throughout this season. My name is Zara Kudishnaz, and in next month's episode, we'll be chatting with theatre maker and dancer Ian Wilkes. I'll catch you then.